capitalize. Back to Austin Taylor. Now around, inside. Hanke coming up with the big denial. Fitzgerald needing help, trying to point out in traffic, has to put it up. Around there in the end zone, and that is the dagger in the game winner. Austin wins it all, 21-20, and advances to championship weekend for the first time.
Welcome back. We are set with the four championship weekend contenders for 2023. Austin, Minnesota, New York, and Salt Lake will be traveling to Eagan, Minnesota on August 25th and 26th. That's after each of those four teams took care of their divisional championship games this past weekend. Hi, everyone. I am Adam Ruffner. That is Daniel Cohen. We apologize for being a day later than we normally are. I came down with a little bit of a sickness yesterday, was in no shape to be in front of the camera, but we are so glad to be with you today after a thrilling weekend of Ultimate. Austin and Atlanta going to the first double overtime game of 2023. New York setting a new single game record for fewest turnovers in a matchup against their fiercest rivals, and without two of their most notable big offensive starters in Jeff Babbitt and John Lithgow, one of the most impressive performances ever from the reigning champs. Salt Lake took care of business at home against LA as the Aviators made continual attempts to get a lead in that game. They got it in the middle part of the game, but Salt Lake just too much throughout all four quarters, their offensive execution once again leading them to a victory. And then in Minnesota on Saturday night, the home team Windchill taking care of business as well in front of their home fans. They punched their first ticket to championship weekend in franchise history and now set up a semifinal game in front of a home crowd. The first time that's happened in this league since 2018 when Madison, of course, hosted championship weekend, and they got the title in that season. We have three of the four competitors at championship weekend making their first time appearances at the event. And then we have this New York Empire team who, after this weekend, not only can acquit themselves as, I think, the best team this season so far, head and shoulders above everyone else, but really the best team we've ever seen, no doubt about it. They have clinched a certain pedestal, I think, above the rest of the competition, and it's up to the rest of the AUDL at this point to show if they can really make something of this empire in a matchup and get a win, break their now 28-game win streak. New York could tie the all-time record if they win on the semifinals and win a second straight championship on August 26th. They would tie the 2013 and 2014 Toronto Rush for a 30-game overall win streak. Daniel, what were your big takeaways from this weekend? It felt like there was just a full gamut of kind of competitive options available. We have the thriller in Atlanta, Austin coming away with another slate of huge plays down the stretch to secure a big win against a rival in the South Division. You have New York playing the most pristine Ultimate we've ever seen. Not only did they beat the single game turnover record by a two-goal margin, they only had two turnovers through midway through the third quarter. It felt like they even gave up a couple that they didn't need to. It almost looked like they might actually pitch a perfect game, something that I think was completely outside of even the hypothetical realm. But the Empire, once again, bringing that kind of, I think, success into a reality that we haven't really seen in this league before. But again, where does your mind go after we now have narrowed down to the final four competitors of the 2023 season?
Yeah, I love that this year it's like the clearest target is on New York's back. Like, I think last year, of course, it was on New York's back too because they had the perfect season going. But going into championship weekend last year, I feel like there was some talk about Carolina beating New York in the semis and maybe Colorado making some noise. Chicago obviously had been ascending in recent seasons. This is like, I just love it. It's a totally fresh slate, and then it's New York. It's the team that's been there before. It's the team that has been winning at more than every other team in the league combined over the last few seasons. And then it's three newcomers who I think are all like chomping at the bit to make some noise in their first ever championship weekend appearances. So I think there's going to be a lot of fun games. There's going to be a lot of excitement and just guys playing with nothing to lose. I think there's a lot to look forward to in 2 weeks.
That's right. And just to set up the matchups, on Friday night, August 25th, are the two semifinal games. Austin will get the first crack at New York in semifinal number one. And then Salt Lake will face off against the home team, Minnesota Windchill, in the second semifinal. The winners of each of those games will advance to the AUDL championship game on Saturday, August 26th at TCO Stadium. But to your point, again, three of these competitors brand new to the championship weekend format. New York, of course, the most pedigreed team in the league at this point, trying to become the first team to win three championships as a franchise this season and also become the second team to win back-to-back titles, joining the Oakland Spiders of 2014 and 15, actually back when they were known as the San Jose Spiders. Still Bay, still same vibes. It feels like, you know, we'll get into the matchups and the previews later. Let's talk a little bit more about the games that actually were. So let's start in the South Division. Austin's 21-20 win over Atlanta. Just a thriller from the outset. You were the one kind of, I think, mainly focused on that game. You and I were in a Slack channel. And about, I think, like 4 minutes into the game, you just start messaging me like, this one's a hot one. Like, there's a the fierceness energy in the South. I mean, we've talked about it. I feel like it's been underplayed a bit this year because there weren't as many games between the top three teams during the regular season as we might have liked. Austin and Atlanta only met one time prior this season, so there wasn't a whole bunch of, I think, specific head-to-head buildup between these two teams, and that didn't last long in Atlanta in Silverback Stadium last Friday night. These two teams were heated from the top, very physical game, both teams getting multiple TMUs. It felt like a little bit of that could have come down. There was a little bit of, I think, back and forth. It felt like the refs lost a little bit of control over the physicality in that game, and it resulted in, I think, some makeup plays from both sides. But down the finish line, it really felt like both teams were just at a different level. I mean, you have Kyle Henke playing out of his mind once again. He's been on one of the best playoff streaks we've seen now, even going back into 2022. I mean, he almost has a personal top 10 in his last three playoff appearances alone. The sole defense, while they didn't get a ton of blocks, I think they just finished with five on the game, they were once again sterling in converting defensive break opportunities. Obviously, a couple of times, head coach Steven Nagy using some really critical timeouts to spell on the offensive unit. But the sole defense still took care of business a handful of times in converting break opportunities. And that was all important in getting their first South Division championship. What were you most impressed with by the Soul? Was it kind of their competitiveness? I thought in the first half, they did a really good job of kind of rallying back from some of their early execution mistakes. It felt like they always had their chins up. They didn't really get down on themselves. Whereas on the flip side, it felt like Atlanta has been playing such pristine ultimate for a majority of the season that once that pressure started to cause a couple of lapses or drops or uncommon mistakes for this Hustle squad, there was a seriousness that set in for Atlanta that just wasn't necessarily reflected in their opponents.
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it. It was just the ability they had to punch back, and you saw it. The first quarter was, what, 6-4 Atlanta after one? And I think they went up 2-0. So, like, Austin kind of immediately had to dig themselves out of a hole, which they did in the second quarter. And then from that point on, it was pretty back and forth. But also, looking at the end of the game, like, Atlanta had some huge clutch blocks. Like, Justin Burnett at the end of regulation had that incredible read and handler defense. You had Hayden Austin-Nabb snatching that disc out of the air in the end zone. Like, Atlanta was playmaking, and Austin just maintained the confidence and the mindset to answer with pretty much everything Atlanta threw them. Austin threw something back. So it was just an incredibly impressive mental game, I feel like Austin showed throughout. And I think that bodes well heading into championship weekend. Like, I think we've talked about Austin being like a relatively untested team. Well, here they're coming off back-to-back wins over the two other top teams in the South. And I think there's some mojo happening in Austin too. So I think they're feeling good about themselves, and I'm excited to see how they play against New York.
I mean, he really backed up his words this past weekend. Kyle Henke was running around, and we've said it a few times on this show, talking about Austin playing with house money, and that's exactly how they looked down the stretch of that game, where it felt like any number of points they could have kind of succumbed to the playmaking, the home crowd energy that the Hustle were feeding off of. You point to those two big blocks at the end of the fourth quarter and in overtime from Burnett and Hayden Austin-Knabb. The play that we haven't mentioned, the actual peak moment of the night, was the no-look greatest from Matt Smith to begin the third quarter that ended up at number two on SportsCenter. Just an all-time great play from, once again, the second leading all-time goal scorer in this league's history. He's been fantastic in his three career playoff starts and yet doesn't yet have a win to show for in his last three playoff starts, excuse me. Atlanta did win their first ever playoff game way back in 2016 in a first-round matchup against the Flyers, advanced to face Dallas in the South Division Championship of that year, and since has lost three straight playoff games. But it's not because of Matt Smith, because I tell you what, he gets the greatest in this game. He gets his 300th goal with a layout in the 2021 game against New York. Against Dallas, he had a similar SportsCenter level play with a huge sky and isolation coverage over a rookie, Matt Jackson. Like, Matt Smith, again and again, proves to be one of the most competitors in this league. And in general, Atlanta played a good game. And we'll say this about another team this weekend where it's just like, they played good games. They went out there and competed in ways I think that they would go home at night. And if everything was equal, you'd say, give it my best shot. We could have won. Didn't quite fall out in our favor. And yet, because it's the South Division title game, there's no sense of any kind of catharsis for submitting your best effort when you come up this close and don't come away with a win. I mean, in sudden death double overtime, Atlanta had the disc on the goal line with a chance to just win and punch their ticket to championship weekend. Could not do it because guess what? Kyle Henke said no on the end zone line. And then Atlanta gets the disc again and they make a turnover in the flat and Austin converts a red zone opportunity. Absolute pandemonium. And a big congratulations to Austin, who has now really capitalized on the franchise's greatest season in its entire tenure. They go to championship weekend for the first time. They get their first South Division title and they get wins over their closest divisional rivals. Just a real capstone achievement for the Soul Squad, who is still, I think, a couple years away from their actual primes. Like, I think we think of this Austin team because they're so bodacious in their playmaking, because they have that swagger you're talking about, as being a little bit further on their developmental curve than they maybe realistically are. Like, this is a team with still a good amount of headroom between where they're at and I think where their ceiling is. And it'll be really interesting to see if this semifinal matchup with New York can pull them up to that level, or if New York is just a caliber above. Like, I think that this Soul team might be, other than Salt Lake, the most interesting matchup for New York in this championship weekend slate, just because of their potentiation, right? Just because of that unknown factor of how high does the highlight ceiling go for the Austin Soul. I mean, we enshrine Henke, but there were numerous efforts throughout this entire lineup. I mean, Joey Wiley was going off on both lines again. He had a big sky and a response score, I think, not too far after the Matt Smith greatest, or maybe it was in the first half. I might be conflating that, but Joey Wiley made some big plays. Oliver Fay had an incredible layout takeaway in the fourth quarter of this game to put Austin up two, that kind of padded them a little bit.
That also felt like it could have been the clincher. And then Atlanta like stormed back. Like, Austin went up by two with, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes left in the fourth.
It was 19-17.
I was like, is Austin actually going to close out this game on the road over Atlanta? But Atlanta fought back, and then Austin, like those last, I don't know, 7+ minutes of game clock were some of like the most entertaining game minutes I've ever watched, like from the Fay block onward, probably.
But we shouldn't spend too much time in the South Division because we've got three other divisions to get to. We'll start off with the West Division, the other Friday night matchup between LA and Salt Lake. LA did such a good job of starting this game off on the right foot. You know, on their first possession, they open things up and get a huck immediately from Brandon Van Dusen to Evers Shapiro to start the scoring, I believe, in under like 30 seconds of game clock. They just come out immediately, quiet that Salt Lake home crowd and kind of assert themselves in a way that I think few road teams do at Zions Bank Stadium, right? Like, we've talked again and again about the momentum and the kind of break train opportunities that the Salt Lake team can generate at home, particularly in the first quarter, and just put opponents' hopes out of reach within the first couple of minutes of a game and just sort of onslaught you from that point. And the Aviators did not allow that to happen. They really came out with their A game, I thought, especially as far as their offensive execution. I think we had some questions after their first round matchup against Colorado as to where exactly they would fall against such an aggressive and young and playmaking heavy Shred defense. And I really thought LA, again, looked like the best version of themselves that we've seen in 2023. They were able to get out and do some transition looks. Obviously, that opening hook kept things open and available. But then from that point, they orchestrated a bunch of really nice possession-based drives. Michael Kioi, playing in his 100th game in this league, scores a handful of goals. And it's just, once again, one of those reminders that for as good as the Stars have played for LA this season, it's really been about elevating the entire level and allowing all seven of those offensive players to become weapons. And I really think you saw LA continuing that kind of strategy throughout their last game. And yet, as good as LA played, Shred's offense just played better once again. I mean, there were times where LA got pressure. There were times where they made plays. There was that contested disc in the end zone between Jay Stunabaugh and Mitchell Steiner that's had some talk online about. It does look like if you slow things down to like a Zapruder frame-by-frame level, you can see Steiner get possession a moment before Dunabile. But nevertheless, other than like singular moments, it just felt like another performance from the Shred offense where they were just in rhythm from first quarter through fourth. And once again, kind of leading that charge was Jordan Curry. He's 27 for 27 on the night, 8 assists, 3 goals, and particularly down the stretch, it was almost like they were running set play red zone looks at practice for him. Like, it's just, we debated in one of our pregame shows about who you would rather have in the red zone, a Pavlyanis and a Jordan Kerr, and I swear Kerr heard that before the game or something, because he just came out and was just showing the complete bag of throws that he has in close quarter situations, excuse me. And, you know, Pavel, to his credit, too, had a bunch of really nice red zone possessions. He had that great end of third quarter, kind of waiting patiently for a look to open up and finding, I believe it was Sam Cook, buried in the corner of the end zone for a scooper at the last moment, or maybe it's Marcel Osborne. But anyways, I was really impressed with LA, and yet on the other side, Salt Lake was just that much more impressive. They continue to look like a top offensive unit this year. What was your most impressive thing coming away from Salt Lake's first West Division title?
Yeah, it's the ease of their offense. Like you mentioned, maybe there were a few moments where LA like actually got pressure, but I feel like more often than not, if you just kind of click to a random timestamp in that game and Salt Lake has possession, they just like, they're so flowy and so effortless with the way they run their offense. And we really don't see that in many other places around the league. I mean, obviously, New York's offense is pristine and arguably the best in the league, but they still have possessions where they're just like needing to grind out like 30 to 40 throw possessions. I feel like no other team has like 10 throw or fewer possessions than Salt Lake, and they just like churn yards throughout the field, and I feel like they rarely take negative yardage too.
To your point about the comparison with New York, I think that, you know, in our mind's eye, these are very equal teams, but Salt Lake has always had the higher efficiency. And I think that's because New York, as you were just kind of alluding to, as good and balanced as they are, and they definitely showed that on Saturday night against DC, there are times where they will just go back to kind of a two-man game and allow either Jack Williams and Ryan Osgar, or Jack Williams and Elia Chartok, or Jack Williams and SRB, or Jack Williams and a pot of plant to kind of like work a little bit, like wear out the defense, and then sort of pick and choose. And Salt Lake has components of that. They do that at times in the red zone, but it just feels like they use all seven players so much more efficiently and smoothly, where there is just that fluidity, especially sideline to sideline. I feel like two of the more underrated throwers in this league and that we don't talk about enough are McKay Jorgensen and Luke Jorgensen, and their ability to just pivot everything from one side to another, no hesitation. Mm-hmm. They always seem to make the right read as to when to engage upfield and to kind of gouge and get some gainers, and when to do that just seamless, no hesitation, full field pivot, engage the full 40 yards width of the field and get that kind of full scope perspective on where our attacking options are downfield. There's no ability for the defense to kind of recover when they do those transition looks. There's no it's stickiness so quick. With the disc. There's no disc stoppers. Even Kerr, you know, to his credit, as somebody who had the second most assists in league history last year, he kind of was a little bit more, I think, of a stopper. You know, he would get the disc, park for a moment, look for his options, and then maybe it's all four, find a reset, something else.
Right.
Him this year, I feel like, has accelerated that decision-making process, and it's either, is the look there? No, dump it, keep it moving. Like, they're just always willing to make that extra pass. And you're saying, like, they never move backwards, which is really interesting because in comparison to an indie team that we often credit for having very smooth and rhythmic offense, Indy loves to take huge dumps. They did it all game against Minnesota, and they did a good job of staying in rhythm with that. They kind of make a vertical dimension almost backwards so that then they can create more space again and stretch out some more of those swing passes.
Yeah.
But Salt Lake never does that. Salt Lake is never taking some big dump in order to kind of regain a little bit more perspective on the field. It's just continuing it with, if it doesn't work on the right side, continuing it back, and then just looking for those continuation looks as they open up. I'm just always enamored at watching how teams construct space on the field. And I really think we're going to see three of the best this weekend in New York, in Salt Lake, and in Austin too, just because Austin has so much confidence in their playmaking and can stretch the field so much vertically with Jake Radak, Mark Evans, et cetera, distributing the disc. Duncan Fitzgerald, he had a fantastic South Division Championship game. We haven't mentioned him yet. Probably my pick right now for most improved player. But, you know, it's just this thing of, it's really interesting to watch these offenses and how they manipulate defenses. And I think Salt Lake has to be considered kind of the preeminent system right now. Like, they have the stars,
probably,
but they don't quite rely on them in the same way that, like, a New York does, per se.
Yeah, well, and so much of it is just, like, the quick disc movement. Like you mentioned, Jordan Kerr maybe was getting to stall four or something before some of his decisions last year, but I feel like everything is happening in the first three stall counts. At least, like, that's the optimal version of this offense, right? It's just, like, getting the disc out quickly, and it's typically going to either your first or second read. Like, there's not too much, you know, looking back for your dump, needing to reset it 10 yards, because there's typically someone that's always filling space, like, at the perfect time. That's the other thing, just, like, the cut timing and the overall chemistry of everything happening downfield away from the disc, it's just been perfect all season, and it's incredible to watch that just continue throughout a full four quarters of the game, because you kind of think, like, there's bound to be some lulls, especially with the Aviators defense that, you know, added back Jason Valley and had kind of been starting to peak towards the end of the season. It was like they weren't even there at multiple times throughout the game.
Yeah, I mean, there were stretches in that second and third quarter where it just kind of felt like Salt Lake was stepping onto the field for O-line possessions and just working through practice sets. Again, that third and fourth quarter where they just kind of continue to work down into the red zone, get the disc to Kerr, and allow him and Dunabal to just sort of work a quick two-man at the front cone. Like, it's just so easy. And again, it's a little different, I think, from how New York employs that. Whereas with Salt Lake, it feels very quick. It feels like they'll look that way. They'll engage that two-man quick. If it's not there, they'll redistribute. Whereas New York will go 2 minutes at a time and just clear out and let people work into a groove.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's. I feel like that's part of the strength of New York, too, is especially when they get a lead, just milking that much more extra clock for those red zone possessions. Or otherwise, they had one possession towards the end of the Breeze game where they were just, like, casually killing clock for, I don't know, 3 minutes in the fourth quarter. It was just like the Jack Williams, SRB, Chartok in the backfield. And then they work it up to Ryan Osgar and he just like shoots one to Yacht. And it's like, they always have that kind of in their back pocket, just chuck it up to someone downfield. But they're so content just working the disc slowly. And that is like a pretty main distinction, I would say, between them and Salt Lake for sure.
Yeah. Although both kind of have, to your point, like a spring-loaded quality where they do a lot of resets and swings and kind of backfield work almost to
and
set up that one release downfield for New York.
Right,
obviously, it was Ben Yacht all over the place this past weekend. for Salt Lake, it's been this season, I think, Jace Dunabile. I think we expected a little bit more of that from Elijah Jaime, but he's been implemented as kind of an ultimate scalpel. Like, he just releases at perfect times. I think they kind of allow him to sit back a little bit more, churn and burn with his single matchup coverage, and then just pick his spots that much more selectively. And I think that's really worked out for them. They have such a comfort level in each of their roles on that offense.
When you mentioned Duncan Fitzgerald as most improved, it just got me thinking about the Salt Lake offense in general and how I feel like every single player on that team has improved. Jace Dunabile has got to be in the conversation. Sean Canole, Jacob Miller. Like, I feel like the list goes probably seven deep, especially on defense too, where they've gotten production out of these guys that we really didn't know a ton about last year. So it's probably like the most improved team I would give to Salt Lake, even though, you know, they just had one additional regular season win. But of course, they did make it to championship weekend this year, past Colorado. It's going to be a hotly contested award. It's nothing against Duncan Fitzgerald, because obviously he has made kind of the ultimate switch from defensive role player to offensive superstar. But just wanted to shout out some shred guys as well.
I mean, that award is going to be the hardest award, I think, to decide this year, most improved. There's
probably
just way too many good candidates for it this year. And again, for me, it's Fitzgerald, just to sidetrack for a bit, because I remember you were sending me a player chatter article before the season start, and there was a quote in there from Kyle Henke talking about how Fitzgerald was going to open some eyes being on the O-line. And I thought you made a typo. I thought it was Fitzgerald's going to open some eyes on D-line. And I'm like, yeah, you know, like when they added him, I'm like, Fitzgerald is a fantastic piece for their defense. Like, he's got that kind of electric energy. He's good off of a turn. He's shown a little bit of throwing skill off of turns. Like when he was in DC, he threw some great throw and goes on defensive counterattacks. I wasn't prepared for him to be bombing it from the backfield, taking this 40-plus touch role, throwing the game-winning assist in double overtime to help them advance to championship weekend. Like, it was just so far beyond what I had imagined. And that's why, again, I sit here and I'm not on the sideline holding a clipboard or doing something more important. But anyways, that's just why I thought Fitzgerald. Getting back to Salt Lake for 1 second before we move on to Saturday's games, Minnesota and New York wins, of course. You know, going into the season, one of the biggest splashes in an offseason filled with big moves was Grant Linsley joining Salt Lake. And we thought of it as being kind of this ultimate ad piece for a young team looking for a bit more of a competitive edge. You don't get more decorated veterans than Grant Linsley. He's won at every level of his playing career throughout his entire playing career. He has multiple gold medals, multiple club championships, multiple college championships. He is a winner through and through. And yet, in this West Division title game, he was kind of a role player. He was just kind of a part of the whole system. And in talking with Shred people throughout 2023, they've kind of emphasized that. Like, they for certain understand the caliber of professionalism and talent and everything that Linsley brings in. And yet at the same time, they were very careful to say, like, this is the Shred team that he is coming into. We love Grant. We want to make him as much of a part of this franchise as possible, but we have something here and we're confident in that. And I thought it was such an accreditation to the coaching staff, the franchise, Grant, all the players, that they kind of carried that through the West Division title game. Like, I was half wondering going into this matchup, if LA keeps it close, are they going to flip the Linsley switch and have him go off like he did in the 2019 championship game, where he was arguably the best player on the field in the biggest game of the season? You know, was it going to be kind of one of those Grant games, or even like kind of what he did in his Shred debut way back in week one against Seattle, where the second half was a lot of kind of showing off the chemistry between Jordan Kerr and Grant Linsley as downfield playmakers. And in this game, I struggle to think of many touches for Linsley. Like, he was just really a cog kind of facilitating everything. But I think you can't understate the kind of field general confidence you have when it's just, you look over and there's Grant Linsley redistributing the disc, running a reset pattern, you know, just getting into the flow of the offense. Again, it's a credit to both him as a player to step into this completely new environment, completely new region of Ultimate that he's never been in before, yeah. completely new community, and accept that role. And it's a complete credit to Salt Lake to say, like, that's how we want to play Lindsay. We know what we can do elsewhere. We're just going to continue to elevate all of our execution across the board with one of the premier players now on. You know, it's just, it surprises me. I thought Lindsay would be a little bit more of a main player in the system. And it's not to say they don't need him, but they really are getting to a point where you wonder, like, which pieces are sort of necessary because the whole unit is so good. And I think that brings it back to everyone is important to this Shred offense.
Right. I mean, I kind of love that they don't need him to be that same spotlight player that we saw at 2019 championship weekend, because I do think that's like another big difference between Salt Lake and New York. New York does tend to funnel like the playmaking and the touches to their key guys. Like there were many Jack Williams, Ryan Osgar, Ben Yacht connections, both in 2021 when they played a whole season together and what we just saw this past weekend. And Salt Lake, it's just like, it's hard to predict who things are going to run through. Of course, it was Jordan Kerr last year, and of course, he's led the team in scoring this year, but it's also so efficient without Kerr. He could just like be a decoy on one of the rails for a possession. And like, that's fine. If things are flowing as they are because everyone's bought into the same system, that's great. And I love that Grant has just kind of become a seamless piece of that.
There was one Grant play, and he broke away deep, and just Jace Dunabile hit him with a perfect continuation hook, as he's kind of been doing all season. Again, Dunabile's throwing looks, and just his I think selectiveness in that process has become so key for Salt Lake's attack, especially as Jordan Kerr has basically eliminated hooks. He had one hook in this game, in that big open up flick after the big self deflection layout grab that Sean Knoll made in order to save the possession. But other than that, again, it's been condensing Kerr's game while it feels like opening up elsewhere in the Shred offense. But we'll get to more of that later, as I'm sure we'll preview tons and tons as they get set to battle Minnesota again in the second semifinal matchup on August 25th. Let's talk about the Central Division champs, the Windchill. And once again, it felt like it was due to that Windchill defense. It felt like they really stymied Indy at the beginning. Indy did get on track midway through this game. They connected on a bunch of hucks in the middle portion, but it really felt like the Windchill had kind of established enough of a gap where it would take something kind of incredible for Indy to get back in that game. And once again, Dylan DeClercq making a whole series of plays for that D-line. But on the offensive side, I think that's where I started to get a little bit more confident in Minnesota's chances at the Final Four bracket. And that starts with, I think, who has now become the team's MVP this season, Will Brandt. I mean, that kid's it, man. We talk about bags, we talk about confidence, we talk about throwing repertoire. I don't know that Brandt has too many superiors to him. He doesn't necessarily have the experience at this point. He's still phenomenally young. You know, like he was a teenager at the beginning of the 2021 season. And yet the way that he's sort of taken over and really taken the keys of this Minnesota offense, and you see how dynamic they can look. I mean, he's just kind of got it all. They run these red zone sets where he picks up and he can just shred a double team within a moment's notice. He had one where he just did this fantastic, like, low step out to Krennic on like a fourth side. Their game in the red zone is also becoming something to watch for right now. Like, it is pristine between those two young playmakers, but just everywhere else, he has a verve to his game that I think the Windchill offense has lacked without Abe Coffin necessarily being healthy and available enough to kind of own that role himself. Like, we've known that this Minnesota offense is talented for a long time. They have good pieces in various spots, but as we talked throughout the season, they've struggled with that contiguousness, that wholeness, right? Like, it feels like 2 to 3 people get into rhythm and then it kind of falls apart. With Brandt, it really felt like for the first time all season, this offense had kind of that fulcrum on which they could rely on and kind of drive forward with, even as they had a couple of errors and mistakes in the middle part of this game and Indy did get a couple of break scores. they kind of just went right back to letting Brandt quarterback things.
Yeah, it was interesting because, like, I did not anticipate Brandt would have 50 completions and no one else on the team would have, I mean, Klain was second with 33. I feel like Will Brandt's kind of been slotting into a variety of roles over the years. Like, his debut with Andrew Roy in that game against Madison, that was like, he was kind of a go-to handler in the early parts of the season. Then I feel like as Minnesota has kind of added more pieces to their roster and as it shifted around a bit, they've kind of tried him out in sort of like a midfield hybrid type role or just like a rail cutter at times. Clearly, good things happen when he has the disc. And I do feel like they've kind of been missing a key central cog in the backfield basically since Andrew Roy left, right? Like that was Roy's role for the past two seasons. So I think they're onto something with this. And obviously this offensive efficiency was one of their best since the early parts of the season. They converted 63%, 17 of 27. I think coming into this game, we expected their defense to definitely outconvert, their defense to be their strength over their offense and Indy's offense to be their strength over the defense. But the Minnesota offense actually outconverted Indy's in Minnesota. So I think that's a huge nod to their development and the fact that they're getting the best pieces in place when they need them most. Should be interesting. It sets an interesting table for championship weekend where they'll be playing a Salt Lake team that obviously has the best offense, most efficient offense right now. Can Minnesota potentially keep pace with that? It's going to be interesting.
I mean, their other results against a West Division foe from Colorado in week 10 doesn't necessarily predict the best result.
That was a train wreck
for Minnesota.
Offensively,
but that was, yeah, I mean, that was arguably the Windchill's worst game in the last three seasons.
That was awful.
Like, they looked off from the beginning. Abe Coffin, it was his first game back after missing almost a month. They immediately put him into like a kingmaker role almost on offense or like a king piece.
Yeah.
They tested him as a deep receiver on his first point back from a hip injury. Like, it was just rough going. It felt like in contrast to this game, there was no offensive identity. I mean, Will Brandt finished with an okay game, but that was because he got some, you know, Matt Stafford padding in the fourth quarter looks. But
sure,
it felt like at that point in the season, Minnesota was kind of too transitory between what they had developed in lieu of Coffin's absence and where they wanted to go with him in the lineup. And I think you saw on Saturday a much more confident approach. And we still want Coffin to be a huge part of the system, but we have other players who have been in it all season who are capable of performing at this level right now. And it'll be interesting to see if maybe after the really good offensive performance in the divisional championship game, if they start to involve Coffin a bit more, and if there is a little bit more 1-2 dynamic with him and Brandt kind of becoming those combo role dealers. I think you were talking about Brandt and how they've played him in multiple roles and how at that time it felt maybe a little frustrating for him to be shifted around. But now it feels like he can so seamlessly move between a backfield operator to an engaged mobile distributor. So many of his assists were on power position throws, getting ahead of his defender. He has a lot of athletic, I think, prowess to him. He's pretty tall. He can throw over marks a lot. And so I think him getting that kind of positional advantage and having so many throws, so many different throwing angles that he can distribute from, it's really complicated to start to try to figure out how do you actually box in Brandt into a space where he's not comfortable, because he just looks comfortable everywhere on the field. I mean, his pro debut, I still have, burned into my head because he was picking up against Madison's double team in his first professional game and just doing these like twisting a light bulb high releases over the top, just the big low release stride out because he can use all that frame to get out and around the reach of defenders. Like, he had that from game one, and now you see him really stepping into the confidence of this is his team. And in addition to those kind of tight quarters passes, you're seeing the full range power too. And it's just, he looks like one of the best throwers in the Central right now. And again, I think that he's kind of become the team MVP. I think at the midway point, we would selected someone from their D-line. Sam Berglund was playing incredible after that week 8 win in Madison. But over the last several weeks, as that offense has continued to roll into momentum, it's felt a little bit more like Big Boss Hog, or what are they calling him now? Big Hog?
Hog is his nickname. Is Big Hog the full nickname?
It's Big Hog. He's 6'2", 150 pounds, soaking wet. So of course he's got to have a nickname like Big Hog. But
yeah,
we will be excited to see Big Hog in Minnesota in TCO Stadium. I almost said Seafoam Stadium in TCO Stadium in just under 2 weeks. But let's move to what was actually the most impressive performance of the weekend, at least in my book. All due respect to Austin, Salt Lake, and Minnesota. New York, we mentioned at the top of the show, they set the single game record for fewest turnovers in a matchup in 4 quarters, just 4 total turns for the Empire. They only had 2 midway through the 3rd quarter, which is almost equally impressive to me. They win game number 28. They're now 2 away from tying the record. They're on the precipice of their 2nd straight championship. They go into this game basically with game time news that MVP hopeful and probable favorite to this point in the season, Jeff Babbitt, will be missing the game due to lingering concussion symptoms that he sustained weeks ago. I forget the particular matchup at home, but there was a play kind of in a random moment in the 2nd quarter of a game during the regular season where a defender kind of came down across the top of Babbitt's head. He had to take some time off. It was kind of precautionary. There didn't seem to be a whole bunch of concern then. He's obviously played games since, been super duper effective as he was in the West Division regular season finales for the Empire in Colorado and Salt Lake. Something has come up since. Concussions can be some of the most frustrating injuries to deal with because of how unorthodox they are. And just thoughts go out to Babbitt and the team and everyone close to him, because it's just not fun to see somebody in this position. But New York has to scratch him. And then basically as opening poll is going up, Evan Lepler in the broadcast announced that John Lithgow will also be a last second scratch due to triggering something in warmups. So the 2 big players on New York's offense that have basically been the backbone and the reason for the Empire getting to switch former 2-time MVP Benyat over the defense, not available moments before their biggest game of the season against their fiercest rival, who is looking for the upset absolutely on the road. What does New York do? They now get to play a nobody believed in us, we have to kind of overcome some adversity card, as if this team needed any more kindling inside of its furnace, any more coal to shovel into the flames. They get this, and they respond by having their best game ever. I mean, Benyat sets the single game receiving yards record, which is wholly unstoppable in the 2nd half. It looked like some kind of offensive system that you play against a younger brother or something in like Madden, where you just sort of wait for your biggest player to get open in deep space and then just throw it to him. Yeah. He had 8 goals, 3 assists, 5 hockey assists. He almost completed 30 passes. He wasn't exactly just catching things in the end zone. He was a part of that offense. But the thing is that it doesn't even come close to stopping there, because they still get a perfect performance from playoff Jack Williams, who looked diabolical from the beginning. They get Ryan Osgar looking like absolutely the best thrower on the planet. I mean, his backhands all night were calibrated to perfection. Good. Just stupid good throws and stupid confident, right? Like, he's pulling the trigger 70 yards out, arcing it from near hash mark to far hash mark over 2 defenders through help defense. Doesn't matter. He's not even thinking about that. He's just seeing who he needs to hit downfield. The Chartocks, Elliott and Oliver, were fantastic for the Empire offense all night long. Not a turnover between them. Elliott Chartock finishes with 60-plus completions on the game. And let's stop a moment there. Just a huge bounce back for him. I don't know if anyone remembers, but you and I have talked about it a few times. In that 2021 playoff game, Elliott Chartock had been having a fantastic season. That was his first season with the Empire back in 2021, up until that playoff game against Atlanta. Something happened in the 1st half, and he started to commit turnovers. I think he had 3 throwaways in the 1st half of that game, and the Empire ended up having to shift him to D-line, where he stayed through championship weekend. He played the final 2.5 games of the season after spending all season on offense, on defense, trying to get back that confidence, trying to get out of kind of that yips mindset. I can relate. I had yips for years throughout multiple sports. It's a truly terrible place to be at. To see him go out there not 2 years later and have this kind of performance where he was almost the energy leader a lot of times. He was doing some kick spikes. He's got that weird, like, double Dutch crossover celebration that he does with, like, Charles Weinberg and people. I don't know if you've seen that. It's like a little Chippendales two-step. Oh, man, Elliot's been doing that.
Sounds great. I'm all for it.
But, like, it was just, you know, it's what this Empire system, I think, kind of does to whatever player that they elevate into a further playmaking position, which is just make them feel so fully themselves. And obviously, when you have Yacht, Williams, Osgaard playing the way that they do, that can be easy at times. But credit goes to the Chartocks, Elliot. Charles Weinberg stepped up and had one of his best games of the season after being kind of the sixth and seventh option so many times this season. He had that rocket missile of a assist to Oliver Chartock at one point, and continues to have an ability to open up vertically as a continuation thrower that I don't think we see enough of, just because the Empire don't require it, given how much talent they have on this team. But man, we've talked all season about Salt Lake being the best offense in 2023, and then the Empire do that without two offensive starters, Lithia and Babbitt, and it really makes you reconsider what some of these stats even mean at a certain point.
Right. Well, and defensively too, they converted 7 of 8 despite moving Benyard over to offense. Like, there's, I don't know. I think coming into the weekend, I was relatively convinced that I would consider DC to have the deepest team in the league. I guess I don't know how. Depth is such a weird thing, because it's like, you know, there's kind of like the 14 man depth of like your two starting lines and the ability you have to slot in some of those like 15 to 17 guys. But then there's just like complete lineup depth where it never seems to matter what D line is out there. They're going to convert. They're going to be smart with the disc, and you have an O line that just dominates. I don't know. It's tough to argue that New York doesn't have the deepest team at this point. And I just love Ben Yad had to remind everyone that he did win 2 MVP awards for a reason. He, like, scoring-wise, this was probably his quietest season, just because it was his first, you know, mostly D-line season since joining the Empire. But clearly it's a luxury that New York has to just shift him in as, like, an O-line sub and for him to go off with the greatest receiving performance of all time. Very casually.
I want to get back to Yacht in a second, because I wanted to touch a little bit more on that defense, right? I think that DC, to their credit, they played
a good game.
Like, hats off to the end of the Daryl Stanley era in DC. You know, this was a team that was actually, when he took over, kind of almost a rung below both Toronto and New York in the East Division. They are now clearly eye to eye, I would even say, with New York, even though the results kind of tend to differ. This is a team that I think everyone can visibly see is a championship-level contender. They just can't get past this clearance threshold of the Empire being their divisional opponent at the end of each season. But Daryl Stanley has built up the Breeze to a fantastic point, and it showed again and again in this game. Like, DC, while facing the greatest offensive and maybe performance ever that this league has seen, refused to quit throughout this game. They get the huge David Bloodgood Callahan off of his own pull. I don't know that I've ever seen that in this league. Yes, he pulled that.
Wow.
David Bloodgood pulled it and then got the Callahan on the first throw. Not only that, Solomon Ruschmeyer-Bailey threw the Callahan, and I think that is his second reset turnover in the last 3 seasons. Like, it is somebody who does not make that kind of mistake.
That play, by the way, that had a similar vibe of when, like, Carolina had a super early turnover in the championship game, and then New York, like, maybe punched in the first break of the game, but then from that point on, Carolina was lights out. I feel like from that point on, after that Callahan, I don't know, was that like their first or second turnover of the game? New York was basically
that was their. I think that was the first. The only other turnover I can remember before way late in the game was Ben Yacht throwing a kind of casual mid lane pace. And Troy Holland making a fantastic play to pick it off on the backside. But right. it was that. Those were the two turns before about the 4 minute mark in the third quarter at some point.
Was
just out of this world Callahan and 180% throw. That's it. And so, you know, despite facing that, DC continued to execute. Tyler Monroe, by the way, also had just a fantastic game. Andrew Roy played a fantastic game. There were so many good efforts from this Breeze team, but the Empire just sort of fade all of it, right? Like through their own performances and on both lines. Like we talk about the offense, but the defense too. I mean, they've got this matchup defense line of Antoine Davis and Breton Tan and John Randolph that's just intimidating across the board. Marquez Brownlee had a great game. But then they have kind of these different lineups, like you were saying, that they love to throw of sort of more older piece veterans and stuff that have a little bit more communication between them that can just gum up lanes. And as Osgar said earlier this season, smash the Dros button in order to get blocks or get takeaways. They did that at this point. Another member of that team that I wanted to shout out, Ben Katz. You know, there was that fantastic Evan Lepler article about what he's been working through the past several seasons in the background and off the field with his health struggles. And he's just one of those people. And Dan Hilton said this on the broadcast on Saturday night too, that there's no sense that anything is going on for him other than reading the Matrix line codes of Ultimate being played on the field. He makes different plays. There are plays that nobody else makes. And he did it again twice in this game. One time he got a block, another time he just shut down a deep look. The block is something that is becoming a part of his personal arsenal, which is getting hand blocks on players much larger than him. Kevin Healy reels in this kind of weird fast break hook right on the end zone line. New York sets in this double team trap with Katz and Brownlee. And Katz sits so low on the mark. It's like he basically disappears from the field of vision on the thrower. And he just, it's Jack in the box, man. He can read every fiber of the thrower's arm as they start to initiate a throw. And he's just quicker to the punch. Like, and so he just gets this fantastic goal line jump swat in the end zone. New York leaks out and gets an eventual break off of it. I don't know if it's before or after that where he had the peel off help defense where he was actually the deep in a little bit of a switching one-on-one coverage that New York was running. Mm-hmm. And he had one deep player. He allowed that player to go in knowing that they would just be running into more New York defenders. And he sort of baited a deep look. I think DC was intending it for Johnny Malks. And Katz just fluidly goes from facing under, reading an underpass to just head down, turn around, sprinting deep. I'm beating you to the point and I'm sealing you out of making this play in deep space. Like he does this stuff 2 to 4 times a game. Sometimes it generates a block. Sometimes it will never appear in a stat sheet. But like their, I mean, I don't want to start assigning numbers, but if you were to just kind of rank it out, I mean, he doesn't necessarily always fit into their top 5 defensive personnel on any given line. Yeah. I think of him as being that, given his pedigree and given the number of blocks and given what he's been to this team since he joined in 2018, you talk about a player who's fulfilled multiple roles for an organization. I mean, Katz is playing offense with Ben Yacht and Jabron Meeser in his first season with the Empire in 2018. It's so long ago, you kind of forget about it, but you know, he's been everywhere, and they ask him to go out and play the game he can, and he goes out there and does it. And again, it kind of gets back to what I was talking about with Char Talk earlier. There's the obvious talent. That makes everything easier. I forget which coach it was exactly, but winning makes everything look easier. And when you're on a 28-game win streak, it looks really easy. But there is got to be a credit to Hapez, Nunez, the system, the players, to how can all seemingly just elevate to their best selves. And that's what you saw against DC. Like the question just becomes, what was DC even supposed to do? They did the right thing. Nothing. They even took more deep shots like we wanted them to. They did the good thing isolating Tyler Monroe out into space and letting a playmaker go get a little bit. And it just, what do you got? I mean, Ben Yacht, Ben Yacht just skying over everyone. They're going to isolate Ben Yacht deep five times in the second half. He's going to make every play. What do you do?
That was it, though. Like, I do think if DC did a better job limiting New York's deep game, which is obviously easier said than done when you have Ben Yacht running out there, they would have been a lot more in this game. But yeah, New York converted 12 of their 13 Huck attempts. At some point, you throw up your hands and shrug because it's not like taking those away would necessarily disrupt so much. But New York, it was funny that New York played such an efficient game with kind of like a loose-ish looking play style. Like, they don't always have games where they're up over 10 plus Hucks, but this was just one of those games. They found what was working early, and then all of their good throwers were hitting every throw they needed to. But back to Ben Katz real quick. I don't think I've seen any other player get as many jumping hand blocks as him. Like, that's his move. And, like, I don't know if it's because he's shorter necessarily or because he baits them, but no one does it like him.
Yeah. It's that and the lane poaches. The backside, he'll fake to the wrong side and then, like, peel back and cut back into the lane.
So smart.
He got one in the 2019 All-Star game, I remember, famously. He got one, I believe, last year. Or no, that was Jabron. No, Katz got one last year at Championship Weekend, too. He did the exact same thing where he acts like he's going away from a spot and then just quick pivots back into it all over his blind shoulder. He's a master tactician at this stuff. And it's so thrilling to watch him do it again and again. And again, I just want to give a shout out to not only DC, but all of the losing teams this past weekend. It was one of the more competitive, I think, divisional championship weekends we've ever
Definitely.
Seen. I mean, New York had the largest goal gap at 5 goals, and there was no lack of drama in New York and DC, right?
Right. So just well, also, like you said before, I think it was just so cool that we kind of got incredibly high level, like arguably the best performances of the season from a lot of these teams. Like, LA played a fantastic game, DC played a fantastic game, as they've been doing throughout this back half of
Austin
the season.
Austin had 13 turnovers for the second straight game after
Atlanta,
struggling with that all season.
Right. I would say, like, Indy is probably the lone exception where I didn't feel like they played their peak level of ultimate, but basically every team put on a very impressive performance, and for us to get that in the divisional championship games, like basically across the board, was very fun to see.
So finally, before we kind of dismount into our final outro, I just wanted to touch on Ben Yacht for a second, because he has been such a galvanizing rod throughout his career in this league. Like, he came in with Minnesota in 2014, for those who remember.
Homecoming time.
And was, yeah, a few homecomings, actually. Most notably, I think, for the reigning MVP in Ron Asgar, who will literally be going back and playing in his hometown of Eagan. That is where
That's
he grew up.
Cool.
So, yeah,
also,
there's a few
wait,
Minnesota
Grant
homecoming.
Linsley, is Grant Linsley from Minnesota, or does he go to school there?
I don't know if he's technically from Minnesota. He went to Carleton for college and did play for Minnesota, actually, in his rookie season in 2014 with Ben Yacht. And I wanted to say something just on here, because it's been grinding my gears. I texted Evan Lepler about it during the broadcast. They mentioned that Grant Linsley had never lost a game in the AUDL. That's not true. He's lost. He lost way back in the beginning in 2014 in Madison with Minnesota. Grant Linsley hasn't lost, I think, since that season in the AUDL. He I think, won every game he played for in 2017 with San Francisco in limited appearances.
Yeah.
Won every game in 2019 and 2021. And then this year. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I just had to get that out there. I had to get that stat correction. Grant Linsley has lost in
the people know.
He loses. I just want people to know that he is fallible in one dimension of... Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say. I digress. I want to talk about Ben Yacht for a second, just because we talked about this kind of after the All-Star game, too. We get into so many different cubby holes, I think, with how we talk about the greats in this league, right? Like, we talk about playoff Jack and how he elevates at this time of the year. We talk about Ryan Asgar and possibly being the best thrower we've seen in some time. We talk about Pavel Giannis and Sean McDougal and what they've done in LA. We talk about Jordan Kerr and Salt Lake and this machine-like offense. We talk about all these other stars. And yet, when the dust settles, when you just kind of clear your brain for a moment and think in like a, if I'm just drafting somebody to start a franchise around who will position me the best to win games, is there anybody who clears Ben Yacht at this point in his career? He has two MVPs. He has two trophy titles in the ADL going for his third. He is the only 300 assist and 300 goal scoring member in the AUDL's history, and no one's even really that close to that club except for him right now. Max Shepherd will probably join him in not too long. He now owns a single game receiving record. He is climbing up the blocks chart. He's going to crack into the top 10, if not top 5, in pretty short order. He has two championship games in 2019 and 2021 where he did not commit a turnover. He had like a, how many receiving yards? He had almost 500 receiving yards in the All-Star game this past fall, and continually looked like the best player on the field at times. Mm-hmm. It's just, he becomes unsolvable at times for teams. And again, it's like, we were talking about this before we started taping. It feels easy to just say, hey, Ben, go line up back on offense and do what you did, you know? And he proved himself capable of doing that. Yeah. I think that that is undersold. I don't think that it's so easy to play a season and a half on defense in the ways that he has and just go out there and execute like that in that game, given the kind of disadvantages that they were down, you know, given the just kind of mental state of having to prep for not having Babbitt and Lithiau, who have been there so consistently the past several seasons. Like, his ability now in this stage of his career to now just shift back and forth on offense to D-line, depending on where they need him in any given matchup. What is the weakness to his game? I mean, it's always kind of been turnovers in a certain way.
Yeah, yeah.
But because of the way that he limits them in big games, it doesn't really concern me ever. It's always kind of like he understands, yeah, I can have four throwaways in the mid-season Toronto game.
Right.
That's okay. I mean, I'm going to have one turnover in the East Division Championship stacked up next to 11 scores and 800 total yards.
I mean, of what separates him, right, is like the clutch performances when the team needs it most, right? And it's also just in those late game scenarios. Obviously, he had the buzzer beating catch over DC to send New York's championship weekend last year. He had the block on Brett Holzmeier and the ensuing layout goal in overtime the year before.
He had
the huge sky over Tyler Monroe and Ben Ort, I think, earlier this year when they went
That was what I was going for.
Yeah. It's time and time again, and it's limiting turnovers in those big games. Like, it's, I don't know what more you can ask for, honestly.
2019, he had the deflection goal catch in the championship game. I forget the defender on Dallas who made a fantastic play. I think it was Kai Marshall.
Kai Marshall.
It was Kai Marshall versus Ben Yacht. When Marshall is coming off of a 5-block record-setting game against San Diego in the semifinals the night before, Ben Yacht then goes out the next day and has, I think, 10 combined scores, 0 turnovers, and 500 total yards. Like, it's just, it's silly, man. Like, there aren't many other players who have that kind of resume in any games you could assemble, let alone the biggest games he's played in each of the past four seasons, you know? Yeah. I don't know. It's going to be fantastic to watch him continue to roll in. Kyle Henke is playing an incredible level. Jordan Kerr, as we said, the stars
are really
coming out. And it'll just set up, I think, for a fantastic Final Four bracket. Are there any dismount thoughts you want from divisional championship weekend as we start to transition towards these final three games of 2023?
Here's a thought and a question. Does this Ben Yacht offensive performance change anything rotation-wise for New York going to championship weekend? You think if Lithiau and Babbitt are fully healthy, they just go back to the normal system? Or do you maybe try to get Yacht over in a few more maybe key O-line situations? Or do you at least like revisit the idea of having him on defense?
Can I be glib?
Please.
Who cares? Like, it all works. Like, I don't know. Sure. Run him on offense. Put Lithiau on defense. Do it. It'll probably work. He'll probably get four blocks in the semifinal. Put Babbitt back on defense. He's only you know, theoretically the best defender in the league when he suits up on defense. So that'll probably work too. I don't know, man. Like, at this point, the proof again becomes on these opponents to show where a weakness lies, because that felt like the moment going into that game. Like, oh, as those injuries were announced,
you,
it was like,
you slacked me too. Right. You were like, if like, this is DC's chance. Like, this is the one game they have to beat New York. If they can't do it, then all right, the debate is settled forever.
And, you know, to New York's credit, they came out and responded like they understood that too. And I think that's just what makes them so formidable and scary. And they talked about it throughout the broadcast too. There's just, not only is there the winning, there's the focus on it. They're the most focused team in the league and have been for the past two seasons. And it'll be up to Salt Lake or somebody to show if they can elevate to that, or possibly a Seoul team to outpunch New York somehow. Because it does kind of feel like if there was one team audacious enough to truly challenge the Empire in that kind of playmaking plateau, it might be the Seoul.
Yeah. I can see it. They like to shoot. It's just going to require like a 10 or fewer turnover game from them. But I do think now that New York played this 4 turnover game, like, they can't beat that, right? Like, they're probably going to play a little less efficiently at championship weekend. So maybe that opens up some opportunity for upset potential.
I don't know, man. Every single time.
You think they're going to beat
this? This Empire team can't impress us anymore.
Championship game.
They felt like that was within their grasp on Saturday night.
I know. I really shouldn't put it past them.
I mean, I think you just set another like bulletin board material for them.
Yeah. I hope they're watching those. Yeah. Put it on the bulletin board for sure.
Well, we thank you and the audience for watching us here today on this recap episode of Swing Pass. We'll be back later this week with some form of preview content for Championship Weekend. Obviously, we still have a number of days to go before the formal event, again on August 25th and 26th in Eagan, Minnesota. You can get your tickets now online at theaudel.com. And we'll be wrapping up here today, but we will talk to you soon. Take care now.